Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Peter Crouch is a footballer I genuinely love to see out on any football pitch. He plays with a technical ability and a sense of fun, which I've always found a joy to watch. You don't need to take my word for it, though. A young Pep Guardiola, before he became Pep Guardiola the coach, also saw something special in Mr. Crouch and wrote a sort of love letter, a football love letter, to the striker in 2006, writing for the Spanish broadsheet quality paper El País, referencing Peter's skill, his awareness, and his desire to play for his teammates. I've always really disliked this idea that Peter's got a good touch for a big man. He's simply got a good technical touch. Clever soccer player. In this big interview, we discover a childhood spent learning the game under the Curver method, perfecting skills named after the players who made them famous. Go find out about the Curver method. It works. It's clever. His appetite for practice and repetition has also allowed him to score some genuinely remarkable goals during his career. And Peter recalls some of his best strikes here. He also talks about an admiration for Italian football, an ambition to play abroad, yes, still. And of course, Peter explains the Stoke effect, what it is, and why it consistently unnerves teams like Arsenal so much. Hope you enjoy this one as much as we did. Star Peter Crouch, we love you. Many people, in fact about 4.6 million people, have heard me say, we only do this series with people that we admire a lot, and that's you. The reason that I say that is that whenever I look at TV these days to see a football match, I don't follow necessarily a club or a team. Yeah. I say, who do I want to watch playing? Yeah. And from the minute I saw you, I've enjoyed your technique and your touch and not just the fun that you play with, but the creativity. And you've obviously got the technical skills to bring these things off. Now, I'm always fairly sure of my views, but when in 2006 you read Pep Guardiola, not yet a coach, and writing for a broadsheet newspaper in Spain called El País, and agreeing with you, it's nice to hear. Now, if you'll tolerate it, this is what he says about you. Can I read you this?
Yeah, love to hear it.
It's not the worst thing in the world. So it's a game where Wayne Rooney doesn't play in the World Cup, and Pep says, but the guy who was there was Peter Crouch. Maybe people might know the guy from Manchester, Rooney, a little bit more. But when you've got Crouch in your team, you have to play for Crouch. And he said, don't worry about it. Playing for Peter Crouch is a big thing. He gives everything to the team. He knows exactly how to lay the ball off, to hold it up for Gerrard and Lampard. He knows how to make brilliant light touches with his head or with his feet for Owen and Rooney when he's back in the team. He does it with his head, he does it with his feet. But one of his best virtues is that he brings all the lines of team into play. He knows that he's playing with 10 others, and it's not just the ball coming out of the heavens towards him or for him all the time. He gives continuity to the play, and he says, the minute the ball reaches Peter Crouch, you can start counting. And he counted 1, 2, 3, 4. He said, you look up, and he's still got the ball, waiting for the right pass, waiting for the lines of Gerrard and Lampard in midfield, and Rio and Terry to move up so that the team is in great shape when he lays the ball off. It's basically a football love letter to your football technique and your football intelligence. You didn't know you'd written that, did you?
In all honesty, I've heard that Guardiola had said some words around the 2006 World Cup at that time, and I knew they were complimentary, but I didn't know, obviously, that went into that much depth.
The purpose wasn't to embarrass you. Does Pep Guardiola, the young Pep Guardiola, who's not yet a coach, has he gone to the heart of how you like to play? Because he's speaking about intelligence, technique and team play.
It's certainly something I grew up on, really. I mean, first and foremost, as a kid, I wasn't playing as a target man. I was all about technique, you know, and I think that stood me in good stead as a player. I think, of course, I've adapted my game to the strengths that I have. Everything as a kid was revolving around technique. I went to Corver as a kid. I don't know if you aware of Corver.
Phil Corver, the founder of Dutch footballer,
I did a lot. My dad was big into it. Every young player had a ball, you know. It was all about technique and things like that. That was obviously where, you know, that kind of thing came from. I worked very hard at that. But obviously, with his words, obviously the team play, and I think that sort of, that's just come with probably how I am, really. I think, yeah, of course, I want to win. I want to do as best I can individually, but the way he's talking, obviously, yeah, of course, I try and hold the ball up. I try and bring others into play, and I try and get in the box and get on the end of things. I think that's a simpler way of putting it.
So let's put our foot in the ball now. Corver, explain to the audience.
Well, at the time, when I first started going there, I was about 10 years old. I think it was a massive thing for me, helping, you know, develop my career, and the fact that it was groundbreaking at the time. You know, the English way of playing when I was growing up was very simply just play games, and there wasn't a great deal of thought going into it. I think it was just more about enjoying it and playing 11-a-side and not so much about concentrating on you with the football and you enjoying the ball and getting to do different skills. I mean, I always remember there was names of players and different skills, and you had to go away and you had to perfect them, and you had to come back next time and you know see how you'd improved and got the skills. And it was like the Van Basten, the Lipbarski. I always remember them.
Let's put a foot in the ball again then. Yeah. So I remember Peter Lipbarski.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the Van Basten? What was the Lipbarski? What else was there?
The Van Basten was was basically a step over. Was a Van Basten, but it was just the way you could relate it to players made it more interesting.
Yeah, of course.
And Lipbarski was just as simple as you put your foot on the ball and you drop a shoulder and then then move to the other side. And there was obviously Maradona, which was basically where you stand on the ball and turn. I don't even know what that. It's probably got a new name for it. The kids have got these days. Yeah, it was basically one of those where you turn in the middle of the pitch. And
is it like what sometimes gets called the Zidane thing?
Yeah,
where you
exactly
put your
right.
stand and you turn
stand
your body and you're away from the player.
Yeah. It was little things like that, and I think that and coupled with going out every day and playing with my dad and playing with friends and stuff like that, I think I worked on obviously all the techniques that have stood me in good stead now, and then obviously we put that into a team frame, and I think you got the makings of being going on to being a player.
So the Corver method is something that wasn't then well known.
No.
Now has grown a little bit, and we don't share a lot of resemblances, but we do in that my dad was a massive fan of the co-founder of that,
right.
Charlie Cook, who played at Chelsea.
Yeah.
So your dad would have loved Charlie Cook, but of course we gave him at Chelsea. He's a mighty Aberdeen legend.
Yeah.
And my dad said he's the best player he's ever seen playing for them. So this Corver method, I mean, how do you end up? Whose idea is this?
In all honesty, it was probably my dad. My dad's a big, huge influence on my career.
Chelsea man?
He is, yeah. I mean, I'm Peter after Peter Osgood, believe it or not. I mean, he was a big Chelsea fan.
And is there a rabbit story?
He had a rabbit called Kerry Dixon back in the day, yeah. He's another, obviously, hero when I was growing up. But, yeah, I mean, he's a big influence on my career, and I think he obviously wanted me to enjoy it, but he wanted me to be as good as I could be. And I think, you know, we used to go out and play football before school. And obviously I used to play with my mates as well. But he was a big fan of Korver. Obviously, he's a student of the game, my dad. He loves it. I mean, he can tell you, you know, stories right through the 70s, 80s, 90s. So he found out about Korver and just thought, you know, we'll give it a try for me as a kid, and I loved it and just wanted to keep going back, and I just felt it really helped me, you know, later on in my career, technique-wise, I think.
Well, let's do some relic, because Cruyff might have been part of the Korver method. Of course, yeah. Name might have been used.
Well, definitely used, yeah.
For what he's most famous for, I presume, the turn against Sweden in the 74 World Cup.
Yeah, yeah.
But like you said, so what I like a great deal, and what we've talked about hugely across this podcast, is skills development, technique. My desperation, even as a Scot, to see repeated England teams who I could tolerate winning a trophy every 50 or 60 years, lacking the technique to control a game and the passes or first-time touch all the time, every player. And therefore, it really excites me that your dad said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give Peter the best chance to enjoy his career, to have a professional career, and that his skills will be predominant. And that, I mean, that's why I turn on the TV to watch you. But the Cruyff moment, as you said, you can relate it directly to something that happens in your career, because what you're learning on a muddy field in, I don't know, Ealing, Austerlee, I can't remember.
Yeah, that's right.
And also with West Mid.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, West Middlesex Colts, yeah.
You bring that into play when, for example, in a famous hat-trick at Anfield.
Yeah, exactly right, yeah. It's one of my favourite goals, probably just, everything to do with it, really. Obviously, the fixture being Liverpool-Arsenal, Kop End, obviously, and my, you know, it was the third goal from a hat-trick, and, obviously, and the technique as well. So I think, yeah, all those things. I mean, you know, listen, I the way I play now is obviously wholeheartedly now, and, of course, I've got to be good in the air. I'm 6'7", so I've had to probably work on that. But I think the hardest part of the game is controlling the ball and being able to, be comfortable in possession and stuff like that. And I think that obviously comes from the grounding that I had in to do with the core of our, you know, football with my dad receiving the ball. We used to go out with 10 balls in the park, and he used to ping balls from everywhere at me, and I used to get it down and do it in two touch, and it was just repetitiveness, really. And I think that certainly helped me, and of course I had to adapt my game and become, you know, probably more aggressive, better in the air than I actually was technique wise. I had to work on that, but all the other sides of the games, like the volleying and the receiving of the ball, I think came early because of, you know, sheer practice and enjoyment in that practice.
So in the moment when that ball's coming into you for the third of the hat-trick, I guess, and it's coming in from the right, you're doing something that you've continued to practice, I guess, in training for years afterwards. But what is it about? Because in my mind, I'm all relating this to people saying, for England's great problem is they can't win at penalties.
Yeah.
People say, well, it's not worth practicing because pressure, whatever. Whereas there is something in that muscle memory, if you do it repeatedly, there's a far better chance that you'll pull off a Cruyff turn, or you'll send Kolo Touré the wrong way, or you'll finish well once you've turned, or you'll score a penalty. You're a believer in muscle memory and repetitive.
Yeah, certainly. I always remember being with England and Frank Lampard and David Beckham, obviously two fantastic players. And I always remember Beckham used to do five, six, seven free kicks after training every single day. And Frank Lampard used to do five, six, seven penalties every day against the keeper, David James or Paul Robson, whoever it was. And, you see that Beckham so good at free kicks for a reason, and Frank Lampard's so clinical at penalties for a reason. And that's just simply because I think if you repeat doing the same skill over and over, I think you're more confident in the situation when it comes into a game. And, you know, Beckham, the free kick against Greece, something like that. I just feel like, you know, you've done it so many times, you know you can do it, you're more confident at executing that skill. And yeah, you can't replicate the crowd, but you can replicate the skill. And I think if you know you can do it, you're more confident at doing it, then it's so important to practice it. And I think anyone who says you there's no point in practicing, you can't replicate it, is just talking nonsense.
All right. Thank you. And we came all this way just to hear that phrase. Tell the world. I don't mean to send a stupid question, but in the instant that you pull off something like you did against Arsenal, or of the many, many clever, technically superb goals that you've scored, are you thinking? Or can you remember in instances like that, whether it's that hat-trick goal or not, when the ball's coming at you, to what degree does your brain kick in and say, at really high speed, I'm going to do this, this and this? Or is it literally just predatorial instinct? You're doing it without thinking.
The Arsenal goal, there have been goals, different goals, I think. But the Arsenal goal was probably, yeah, I was full of confidence. Obviously, I'd scored two already. And, yeah, I couldn't really. I think it was probably instinct, that goal. But there's other goals, like the one I scored for Stoke, against Man City, the volley.
Yeah.
That I'd actually tried that a week previous. And, you know, I'd actually do it I don't do that in training a lot, but I try it in training a lot, you know, and where it's sort of like it's something that I've thought about previously. I know that I'm actually better at volleying than I am, you know, shooting 30 yards off the ground. So I know that when the ball drops, I know that I want to get it up so I can have more of a chance of volleying it, because I know that my technique at volleying is probably better than it is off the floor.
Gosh.
So, yeah, which is... It's just I've always loved volleying, you know, I've always done it as a kid, and it's something that I've always been okay at. So that is obviously something that is not, yeah, it's instinctive, because
it's more conscious.
It's more, yeah, a bit more conscious, yeah, because I know that, you know, I want to get the ball up to volley it, you know, and I remember trying it against Blackburn actually about 2 weeks before that goal, and the keeper saving it. But it was, you know, it probably gave me more confidence to try it again, and thankfully it did, and it was one of the best I've scored.
There's a little mismatch here, because the Van Basten, when you're doing the curva training, is a different skill than maybe Van Basten's known for.
Yeah.
But you're a great follower, you were a great follower of Serie A football in its golden age.
Yeah.
And Van Basten was somebody who, like Lebarski, I remember often in his day, was great scoring overhead kicks, not scissor kicks. I would differentiate.
Yeah.
And Klaus Fischer.
Yeah.
The Germans were really good at overhead kicks.
Yeah.
But if we can go to another goal that's very, very special for you, for Liverpool against Galatasaray, which is one of your more famous goals, there's a correlation there, is there, between what you saw the players doing and your book, you write really nicely about, like, just your teammates when you're young.
Yeah.
Throwing yourself about in a muddy pitch, trying to volley a ball home.
Yeah.
Am I right that there's a correlation between practice and that goal?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, that goal, over the course of my career, I've been lucky enough to score a few of those types of goals. And the Galatasaray being probably the best one. There was actually one for Portsmouth, I think, against Stoke, believe it or not. That was up there, and Liverpool again, Bolton, similar sort of goal. But I used to do that as a kid. Like, literally, we used to go get someone to cross it in, and we used to all be trying overhead kicks. And I think it stemmed from Gianluca Vialli when he was at Sampdoria. I used to love Sampdoria in that Italian. That was my team in Serie A at the time. When Gazza went out there, it was probably the time where, I mean, he was one of my favourite players. So when he went out there, I used to solely watch the Italian football. Vialli was doing it. I remember Mancini used to score a few of them. Hugo Sanchez back in the day. He was like incredible at them.
It's like you could float.
Yeah, no, it was amazing, you know. And they were the players that we saw doing it. And they were the goals that we always try and emulate. And of course, you can't... You don't practice it so much now. It's a risk of injury these days. You know, when you're a 9-year-old, 10-year-old kid, it's not, you know, you just throw yourself around. And I think the Galatasaray goal was certainly, it didn't just happen. You know, it was for years and years and years we used to try that. And thankfully, obviously, we managed to do it in the Champions League game. And it was a special goal. And certainly one I've got on the wall. Because I've got a few good pictures of it, actually.
It's absolutely sensational.
I've got that one on the wall. It's good.
What was it for you, Italian football? Because it entranced me, and although I didn't move to Italy, I moved to Spain partly because I learned that there's another footballing culture, that they celebrated differently, they talked about it differently, and that although our football culture fed the world, there have been some nice varieties developed since.
Yeah.
What hit you about Italian football?
Yeah, it's mad. You know, for me, Serie A at the time there was the best. We had the best players in the world, for me. I didn't think our league was as strong as that. I mean, the AC Milan team, the Baresi, the Hullet, Van Basten. That was, you know, that what a team that was, you know. And obviously Sampdoria, I loved with the it was like Lombardo, the Vialis, but obviously the Beppe Signori, Lazio team with Boxic, Gazza, players. When Paul Ince went out there with Inter Milan. You know, like, I watched it every Sunday. Even the way, I think it was, what's his name, Richardson, you know, the presenter.
James.
Even when he was just sitting there like this with a little espresso and he was reading the pink paper, you know, and I was like, I just loved everything about it.
Me too. The Dolce Vita looked really appealing, didn't it?
And he was in the sun and I'm sitting there going, oh, I've got to go out in the rain and play football, you know, just watching like Gazza when he had his swimming pool and he was doing an interview and I was just thinking, this is just amazing, you know. So
what sort of stage of your career are you at then?
Yeah.
Still playing for West Mid? Or
I think I was probably on the level there where I was at a pro club. I was probably training at QPR, you know, the local team at Barclays Bank on a Tuesday, Thursday night. And I was on the road, but still a million miles away from that, you know. And
but it's an inspirational view in that case.
Yeah.
You theoretically, as you're sitting watching it, you'd like a piece of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it was more to do with the football. Obviously, it was it was to do with the fact that I think it was more attainable in the fact that obviously the best players in England were going out there as well. It was like Paul Ince and Paul Gascoigne and David Platt.
Yeah.
Obviously, when David Platt was at, he went to
Liam
Barley
Brady had been there previously. Successfully.
Yeah, massive. You know, and it became something that. You know, that was, you know, just, I don't know, like, it was like, that was the pinnacle was Serie A at that time. And I think it's come round again now. Obviously, the Premier League's the best league in the world for me. I know you might say different, but.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's a pound for pound thing about what you want from a debate about football. Who am I to say?
Yeah.
Xabi Alonso comes here and loves it. You know, Matt is here and loves it. PK came and developed. Yeah. Torres came. You played with him.
Yeah.
Saw how well he fitted in, at least for some time. I'm aware of the power of the English league. Like you, you know, I'd always like to see more technique. I'd like to see more mastery of what the ball's there for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, certainly. And I think that they're, obviously in Spain, I think probably, the teams probably play the right way more often than not, you know. But I think in the Premier League, you find sort of, you know, if we went to go and play Arsenal at a footballing game, we'd lose, you know. And I think sometimes in Spain, you know, lesser teams probably try and play too much, you know, whereas in England, I think we just find a way to win against the top teams, which makes it more difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that, you know, the top teams in Spain probably are better than the teams that we have here.
Wouldn't you have liked to have sampled a bit of that?
I would love to go and play and do something abroad. Yeah, I would love to. I've always felt that I've done better against, say, the international level in the Champions League. I've bizarrely found it easier than, say, playing in the Championship, when I played in the Championship, only because teams just didn't know how to handle me, you know. It was like I don't think they played against the player like the way I play, you know. And I think that when I played against teams in the Champions League, like big teams and stuff, they're all used to a different type of player to me, you know. And I found it, I always felt that I was going to score goals, certainly at international level, and always in the Champions League. I just felt that I was going to go into games and I'll be scoring.
But in practical terms, what does that mean? Does that mean that they maybe give you the standoff a little bit?
A little bit, yeah. And give you more time on the ball, probably respect you more. Whereas, you know, if I was playing, you know, when I first started out my career in the Championship, you know, there's no respect. You're just getting clacked from everywhere, you know. And I think, and it's tough. It was a bit tougher.
Would the referees protect you a little bit more at the elite level, well, maybe?
Yeah, a lot more. I mean, I got given, you know, a lot of fouls against me in the Champions League and internationally. And I always believe if I've got a run on a defender, you know, then, like, when a cross is coming in, then, 9 times out of 10, I believe I'll win it. So, You know, when crosses are coming to the box, it was always good for me. And I think obviously my record in the Champions League and international level has always been very good. So.
There was one experience abroad which is completely different from what we're talking about in Sweden, which while you're developing, and I presume was fun.
Yeah.
But there hasn't been a moment when there was a little crossroads when maybe you could have gone to Italy or Spain. It's still something that's an itch that you can't scratch at the moment.
Yeah, it's something like I would love to do, you know, like to sample a different culture of playing as well. And I believe that I'd be able to adapt, you know, like I've never been, you know, someone who's homesick or something like that. I'd go and I'd throw myself into it. Obviously, speaking to Jonathan Woodgate, I know that he... Although, you know, he was ups and downs when he was at Madrid, but he loved it, you know, and he speaks fluent Spanish now, and, you know, he threw himself into it.
I really admire that.
Got a lot of respect.
He's liked, for sure he's liked, and everybody there knew that literally he couldn't have had more bad luck in any aspect. How the team was playing, his injuries, that debut on goal, but he was respected for sure.
Yeah, well, you know, I know that, and I think that, it's the way, like, Woody is such a, like, he's top man, great character. And although he was injured, he didn't just waste his time moping around. He threw himself into being in Spain. And I know that, you know, they respect, obviously, you know, English. I find it notoriously difficult to speak languages and stuff.
It's true.
And we don't...
I don't know why, but...
Yeah, I just think a lot...
You wouldn't be afraid of trying?
I'd love to try. You know, I actually have tried, believe it or not. It's hard when you're, you know, obviously in this country and you're not in the country. But... yeah, I tried and I just found it so difficult.
But I'd
love to, you know. It's certainly something that I want to tick off and try. And...
Well, the man you've talked about here, Luca Viale's in this series.
Yeah.
We interviewed him at length. Our friendship goes back to when he was at Chelsea. But he's an English gent now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's actually done what you're talking about because, like, you know, he's more of a London gent than any London gent ever was. He's fully embraced our culture, possibly even loves it better here.
Yeah.
And speaks in a kind of PG Woodhouse Jeeves kind of language. Lots of chaps here and there.
No, Viale for me was the ultimate. I mean, I bought the Asics boots because he wore them. You know, I bought a Sampdoria top because of him. I actually met him once in Sardinia and I was like, well, you know, I've met a lot of people along the way and no one's ever... You know, I've never been able to not speak. But there's two people. One was Noel Gallagher, and the other one was Luca Viale. Yeah, I literally was like went to pieces when I saw him, just because everything about him was class. I loved him.
I think if there's two ever, you're going to freeze for.
They're not
bad choices. Very different people.
Yeah, very different. Very different.
I've got lots of guidance notes about where I wanted to go next, but I can't. Turn down a chance like that. No Gallagher. What's music to you? I know, I've seen you sing.
Yeah.
I love a bit of karaoke.
Yeah.
We've got an entire section of the big interview devoted to Terry Butcher singing on stage with Iron Maiden. Who are the other? We've got some crap. Harry talking about Portsmouth taking him out with Ryderson coming to the pre-cup final thing fully dressed up as Vegas Elvis.
Yeah.
We like a karaoke in the big interview.
Yeah.
So, Oasis, No Gallagher, why the freezing and what's music to you?
Well, that's amazing. I love the bands and things like that, and my wife's brother's in a band, and we sort of manage them, really, and I sort of like...
Get out of here.
Well, I love it, you know, so I love, like, seeing the up-and-coming bands, like the last few, like, we've seen, like, Catfish in the Bottle, when obviously not massive now, and we saw them at a little barbecue, and my little girl was there, like, literally no one was there, and I just love the transition of watching that to then watching selling out, you know, Madison Square Gardens, you know, or something like that, and then obviously 1975 as we saw where it was like three people there, and just seeing that the growth and liking the music really. And,
so how do you pick where to go? Have you got a venue, or must they come to you because you're you know you're well known and famous? How do you when you're catching up and coming bands?
Yeah.
Where do you find the information? How do you go see them?
Well, obviously with John and Judas of band.
Let's name the band. Let's give them a plug.
Judas, we'll give them a plug. Yeah, Judas. They are
all right.
Yeah, so they. I follow them around really, and it's just a case of what sort of falling into where they're playing, festivals they're playing. This feeling's a big thing where they're all about up and coming bands and getting them on, and they've a lot of the stages dedicated at big festivals. So they play like Leeds Festival,
Gee,
they've played, like V Festival. They've played
sensational.
Isle of Wight they're doing this year. So you end up catching bands just through doing that. And I just got really into it and quite passionate about it. And the wife's really into it. And from that really. And thankfully, as an upshot of that, we met some really, really interesting people. And some of the people were friends with Noel Gallagher. And obviously, we went to Noel's gig. Fortunate enough to meet him backstage, and it's amazing because one of my good friends is his dad was actually the drummer in Oasis, so he knows, obviously he's grown up with Noel, so he's like, oh, yeah, just come meet Noel, and I was like, well, really? And he was like, yeah. It's like just a throwaway comment. Well, you might as well come and say hello. And I was like, well, I obviously didn't try to let on that I was playing it cool, but yeah, because the type of character he is as well, I don't know, like, I think I just found him very hard to talk to.
He's really funny.
Yeah.
He's a genuine rock star.
Yeah, yeah.
He's lived that life that all of us at this table would like to live.
Yeah.
But you weren't thrown out of that gig for fighting, were you?
No.
Because our penultimate guest in the big interview, Neil Lennon, with Lomas at Manchester City, they just decided to prepare a little bit for meeting Noel backstage, and they prepared quite heavily.
Yeah.
They're both steaming. Neil tells the story in the big interview a couple of weeks ago, and they're arriving, and as they're arriving, they fall out about something that Neil still can't remember what it is, and they're knocking shit out of each other.
Oh, really?
And they're thrown out. As they reach Noel and Liam, they're thrown out for brawling at the bouncers. So like the footballers show up, the Gallagher brothers, which,
brilliant.
That's man bites dog. That's all wrong, isn't it? So I think whatever you did when you met him, it wasn't as bad as... Neil, sorry, but you told the story.
Oh, no, that's brilliant. That's class. No, it wasn't that bad, to be honest.
So can you play? Will we catch you on stage guest appearing at V or Leeds or Isle of Wight? There's a yes coming in there.
I'd love to, because I'm friends with the boys, Kasabian boys, good friends with them.
Solid.
And
they had a good year last year.
Yeah, really good year. And obviously we saw them at Leicester. We've seen them everywhere. I'm gonna start learning the guitar. Put it that way.
Quite right.
I'm sure you'll see me at some stage.
Probably singing in Spanish as well.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So, one day.
We've all got to have dreams, and you would never be shy of a karaoke moment.
No, I've done a few karaoke's in my time. Yeah.
Top three go-to numbers?
I think the favourite was "Blame It on the Boogie," Michael Jackson, only because. It always seems to get the crowd going, that one.
I kind of hear you. Like, everybody out there is going to be saying Neil Diamond, because whatever the atmosphere is, if you just do a touch of Sweet Caroline, everybody's with you, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's with you.
It's a crowd pleaser, isn't it? Yeah, it's not my favourite tune of all time, but it's a crowd pleaser.
But you could handle a couple of others. You could handle Oasis, or...?
Oasis, yeah. I did Wonderwall when I first signed for... that's always a go-to one.
What, Initiation?
That Initiation, yeah. It was a QPR, right, when I was a kid. I remember doing Oasis and the air guitar was out. there's been a few. Journey, Don't Stop Believing always seems to get the crowd going.
Can you hit them high notes?
Well, not really, no, but as long as you've got everyone singing along with you, you're all right.
These are the tactics I never learned. I need to go a player that I loved watching, because I don't think we're out of time yet. When I heard you, because we actually, it doesn't sound like it, but we do some research here.
Yeah.
So when you said, you've mentioned Gaza, you mentioned Maradona, people you aimed at.
Yeah.
You also mentioned Roy Wegerle.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, when I first saw him, I thought, whoa, that man can do anything.
Oh, yeah.
He can just dribble. He didn't look lazy, but he looked elegant in a laid-back way, as if, yeah, I'm going to beat a couple of players now, but, you know, I'm going to do it again in 10 minutes. Don't worry about it. It's coming around the corner again.
Yeah.
Just, for people that don't remember Roy Wegerle, just tell me about him.
Oh, I loved him. He was another one, like you say. It was everything about him, you know. He was like, he was different and, you know, like you say, I think elegant was the word. And he would beat a couple of players and then bend one in the top corner. And he was a little bit of a maverick as well. He was a little bit, could be lazy at times. But it was just, I think, a crowd favourite for that. Because he was a maverick and he was such a talented player, and he probably could have been more, really. But you know, I got to the stage where obviously I went to Chelsea as a kid, I was a ball boy there and stuff like that. But you get to the stage where you want to start going with your mates,
yeah.
to games, and the local team was QPR. We could pay. I remember me and my couple of mates, we were QPR fans. We went down. We used to go down there on our own, and obviously the tube from Ely Broadway to White City is a couple of stops, and we pay £5 to sit in the lower paddock and watch a Premier League game. And it, at that time, QPR was a top London club.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we had obviously that Wigley was there, but obviously it was Ferdinand,
Sir Les.
Yeah, you know, MP Trevor Sinclair. You know, some top players, and it was great. But,
was Seaman still in goals, or
Dave's? It was after that. It was Stage Scale, was it?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
And then there was Seaman. I think he was just before me, really. But yeah, it was. I mean, a great team. But Wigley was the best for me. Him and Les Ferdinand probably were the ones that stuck out for me.
So your eye has always been drawn to the entertainer.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And like, you know, I certainly wouldn't class myself in that category, but...
Well, I disagree, that's why we're here. I fully disagree.
Yeah, it's something that I always tried to do. I always tried to, like, as a kid, you know, I wanted to beat players, and I wanted to excite and enjoy it, you know? And I think that, comes across probably now. You know, I still enjoy the game because I love it, you know? I'm 36 years old, and I'm certainly not going to be going anywhere soon, because the day I stopped sort of enjoying playing football and wanting to come in every day and with a smile on my face and looking forward to getting out there. I mean, I'm here now. You know, we didn't play great on the weekend, but I'm here now, and I can't wait to get out.
Literally.
I literally can't wait to go out there with the boys and have a laugh and get stuck into playing. Yeah, it's literally a joy every day. And I think sometimes you look at players and they're like, you know, you can see that they don't really want to be here. And you're like, I can't get memories.
It's a shocker, isn't it? Well, everybody who's in the stands wants to be out there.
Yeah.
And maybe 90% who are in the stands, if they were given the chance to be out there, they probably couldn't handle the pressure or the hits, the operations, the disappointments. But to see a player who's made it, who's been given the ability, given chances, paid well, and they kind of like, you know, they're tossing it off. It's just...
But it's amazing.
It's a crime, isn't it?
It's amazing. You see it and you just think... I mean, you must have enjoyed it to get to the level you're at now. You must have enjoyed it somewhere along the line. How can you not get back to that and, you know, to love it? You know, I see players that don't want to really train, don't really want to, you know, maybe... If they're half fit, you know, do you want to play on a weekend? And it's like touch and go. So you're like, no.
I'm aware of it. You hear it. Players talk
bizarre.
About this.
It's bizarre. And obviously, you know, thankfully, you don't see it that often. But when you do, it's certainly an eye-opener.
There's a happiness here at Stoke we're looking at, and you know, it's a brilliantly run club. Mm. Club I've got huge. They've treated me really well. Yeah. I admire the Coates family, what they stand for, what they've done, what they've done for their club. I think they're living as much of a dream as you, because it is their club.
Yeah.
And here you are in the Premier League repeatedly. Yeah. This is the club you've stayed longest at, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
Just try and sum up some of the things that have kept you here and kept you happy.
Yeah.
It's part of it, though. I mean, that training ground out the back, that's as beautiful as you'll see. I was at Monaco's La Turbie the other week, and it's on a cliff overlooking the Mediterranean, but it's a digger site. There's port cans everywhere. Yeah. This is probably nice. Yeah.
No, it's lovely, honestly, and it's a club we're really, really moving in the right direction. Like you're saying, I think it hasn't got an owner that doesn't understand the place or the
you know,
well-off owner that can afford players, you know, and afford to pay, you know, wages for top players. At Premier League outfit, but it's, you know, he understands the people, understands the club, and I think he's not going to make rash decisions, sacking players after managers after a couple of games. And like you say, I think it's because he's a Stoke fan. I just think it makes it so much better. And it's certainly when I first arrived, when I first walked through the door, you know, I was told, you know, we'll be doing this, we'll be doing this, we're getting these players, you know, we're doing that, and, you know, everything's happened. You know, it's not been a lie. I think we've gone from probably fighting, you know, just getting up and fighting relegation every year to becoming an established top 10 side. Mm. I think if you look at the top six Premier League teams and what they've spent and you know, what they'll achieve, I think they're at a different level, and we're always, you know, just behind them, and we have been in recent seasons, and... For me personally, you know, everyone is really friendly, been great to me. Fans are fantastic. And everything that, you know, unless you're at a top six side, I don't think you'd want to be anywhere else.
You made me smile. I saw you talking about the Stoke effect. Having come here and thought, I'm going to have to work a little bit, and now having been on this side looking at, you used the expression seeing people beaten in the tunnel, didn't you?
Yeah, I loved watching it. It was so funny. You know, having been on the other side of it, you know, when coming to Stoke, and obviously under Tony Pulis, and just seeing, you know, obviously, like, you know, I'm a big lad, but I mean, you see them and you walk around, you just obviously being on that side and coming in, and everyone's like, oh, you've got to come to Stoke. The wind seems to be howling in, and it was, you could see, you know, for me, you know, it wasn't, I didn't find it a problem, but you could see when players just didn't like it. And obviously, being on the flip side of that, being in that dressing room when, you know, I always remember Spurs getting off the bus and it made me laugh. And I just think, you know, they're a different side now, but I remember them just get, you know, looking so cold, and they just didn't want to be there. And you just think, we've got them here, you know. And,
what a sweet feeling before you start.
Honestly, Arsenal a couple of times as well. Wenger just doesn't like coming to the Stoke, I don't think. And the fans whip it up. They make it more. I actually remember we, you know, I think we grew the grass a little bit longer. So I always remember Aaron Ramsey. I mean, you couldn't see. The ball was about halfway like that. And I always remember Aaron Ramsey trying to wrap a pass. And you literally had to shoot to get it 10 yards. And we literally had them beat. But it was very, very entertaining watching it happen.
Aaron Ramsey is a fabulous footballer and a great character too. But you need to be able, I suppose it's like you said about smaller teams here, knowing when you've got to change gear to play in a certain way to win, you've got to surmount, whether it's the weather or the pitch or maybe a slightly robust style of football or fans that are right on top of you. Yeah. To be a great footballer, no matter your skills, you've got to be able to cope with that.
Well, exactly. I certainly think, like in the Premier League, there's so many different ways of, you know, teams playing and stuff. You do have to adapt. And I think the best teams always have. I mean, obviously, you know, the teams that were the best throughout the Premier League years has been the Man United teams, obviously under Ferguson. They'd obviously evolved every time, but they could play any way. You know, they could match any team as a footballing team. They could play on the counter attack. You know, there were times haven't we lost count of how many times in the last 10 minutes they nick goals by just, you know, playing a long ball game, you know, and going from, and then play with wingers, getting crosses in and play through the pitch. They could do everything.
And if they mixed it with them, they could mix it right back at you.
Exactly right. You know, if someone tried to kick them up in the air, you know, Keane's, the Scholes's, you know, they'd all get together, you know, Gary Neville, they'd
Stam.
Get together. And Stam, you know, there was no way they were getting rolled over by any way of playing. And I think the best teams have that, you know, they can always adapt. If a team is trying to, you know, psych them out or, you know, try and get in and about them and unsettle them, then the best teams always cope with that. And I think, you know, look over the course. I mean, there's been times where I've played the Arsenal teams recently and you think, you know, such a talented bunch of players, and you think, you know, why are they not winning the league every year? And, you know, it's probably because they haven't been able to sometimes adapt to horrible games of football. And I think, obviously, when we made it as difficult as possible, when you know, we're playing a lot more football now, and, you know, playing some stuff.
It's really clear.
But the, you know, before we were making it difficult for teams, and that's the way we were winning games. And I do think that there was times where, you know, big teams couldn't cope with that.
Well, train's calling, so we're going to finish on one thing that because I'm going to send a written request with a bottle of red wine for more of this. But for the moment, hold on.
I'm sold. You've sold me. I've actually enjoyed it.
That's instalment one.
Just one bottle.
And that's instalment two, right? Because we pay forward here.
Big Rioja fan as well. I'll take that.
These should be nice. These are brewed in my loft. No, these are proper. I want to finish just by asking you. You probably didn't have time to watch last night. A teammate of yours, Gareth Bale, sent off in a 3-3 draw last Palmas Madrid. I've hugely enjoyed watching Gareth Bale doing what you talked about in Sir Gascoigne doing in Serie A.
Yeah.
My personal view is that in Britain, what he's achieved is a little bit underappreciated, in my view. But according to Harry, who was in the series as well, there was a Gareth Bale who maybe was kind of softer guy coming through compared to the world-class, tough, winning professional that he's become. What was he like to work with? Did you see the potential for this then? And what's your view of what he's achieved at Real Madrid?
I don't think that any of us who have trained with Gareth or played with Gareth are surprised by what he's achieving now at all. I think even in... I mean, I saw the transition where he was a left-back. It wasn't going well for him. And I think, you know, there was talk of him... I think Nottingham Forest were trying to sign him for like 3 years.
There were a couple of clubs tried to loan him,
I think it was... you know, I don't think there would have been too many people that would have been displeased if he had gone at that time. He wasn't, you know, but the way people always say to me, I mean, in training, we were just like, he's brilliant. You know, like he was playing left back, and it's for me, it's like playing Cristiano Ronaldo right back. He was quite easily a forward player, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think obviously he came as a left back, so that's where he played, and he was getting exposed defensively, and everyone was like, well, so he was getting criticised, and then obviously because of the lad, he was a nice lad. I think it was hurting him, you know, and you could see he was losing a bit of confidence, and that was the only thing that was holding him back. The fact that he was playing in the wrong position, and the fact that he was losing a bit of confidence, and then obviously he had that stigma of not winning a game, a
couple of games
And that, I think, was getting to him a little bit. And then as soon as, I think it was Harry or whoever made the decision to put him on the left wing. And then, obviously, you know, we could see it in training. He was the best player in training at left back in the wrong position every day. Every single day he was. He was an athlete, incredible on the ball, amazing left foot. He had everything, and obviously once he got pushed further forward, that was the season where he took off, was the season, you know, I played as well. And I mean, obviously the games against Inter Milan, you know, one in San Siro when he got the hat trick, just blew everyone's mind. Really, it was incredible. And you know, we've got the same agent, and I've sort of grown up with Gareth.
I didn't know that.
So I know him very, very well, really. And when we were at Tottenham, his family were in lovely, his mum and dad, lovely people. And they were in the box with my mum and dad all the time. So we used to go up together and, see our families. And it's amazing, really, because I think I remember saying it used to come from his dad, because his dad was a rugby player in Wales. And he was very quick. It's very similar, I think, to how Gareth plays.
Yeah.
But obviously Gareth was football, but I think that's where he gets all those attributes from is his dad. But what a player, and deserves absolutely everything he gets as well, because what a fantastic person as well.
It makes me happy to hear that. And the joy with which you've spoken about Viali or Van Basten or Gareth is precisely what fires this series. The joy of football, the ability to talk about soccer, to understand better thanks to people like you. And the joy for me just being able to say to anybody who's listening that when I look for football matches, I look to see Peter Crouch or people like you, are they playing? I'm going to watch. Yes. You make watching football worthwhile. And this has been a joy. The Big Interview, as always, is produced by Backpage and me, Graham Hunter. The music you hear is by Beer Jacket. Check his music out on iTunes or Bandcamp. You can keep up with everything that we do, enter exclusive competitions, and put your questions to our future guests by joining the mailing list at grahamhunter.tv. That site is also where you can buy the new, updated version of my book, Barca, The Making of the Greatest Team in the World, my account of the Pep Guardiola era at the Camp Nou between 2008 and 2012. It is in all good bookshops now, but it does make a big difference to all of us who worked on the project if you buy direct at grahamhunter.tv/books. You'll be sure to get the new edition, and you'll be helping us to continue producing independent content like this, which remains free. Thanks for being there.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.